I'm Patty, I'm an alcoholic. I don't know about y'all, but I give a much more spiritual talk right after I've been laid. So I'd like to thank Hyena for that. I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, man, I was having a really good time right until now. My home group is a very sick woman's meeting at the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach. I go there because I look healthy. I want to thank Marty and the committee and for inviting me and giving me an opportunity to participate in my recovery. Donna and Stanley for hosting me, my friend Tony, and everybody else who's been so hospitable to me while I've been here. You guys really know how to throw a party. This is really... I was going to tell you a story about my family being in an airplane crash and everybody being killed, but Earl took that one Friday night, so I'm going to have to come up with something else this morning. My sponsor always tells me when I have an opportunity to do this that I only need to remember two things. I need to tell you my name and tell you the truth. I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. And the reason for that, I don't know about anybody else, but I never knew that what it used to be like was going to be important. If I would have... if I would have known that I was expected on November 19th to report to you what it used to be like, I would have paid more attention to my life. If I would have known I was going to have to report what it used to be like, I would have taken notes. If I would have known about step 4 and 5, I can guarantee I would not have done some of the things that I did. But, are you coming up to finish my talk?
Can I get that?
Does that mean I should start over? Could I get laid again, please? I have to quite honestly tell you, I don't know about talking Sunday morning. The people who are here who know me from California, there's not a single one of them who looked at the program and saw that I was the spiritual speaker who didn't laugh about it. So I hope not to disappoint them. I was a blackout drinker. And so what it used to be like, this is just my perception of what it used to be like. It may or may not be true. I have... A lot of what I'm going to share to you has been reported to me by other people, and I'm going to have to believe that they were telling me the truth, but I didn't pay a lot of attention to my life. So this is just my perception of what it used to be like, and it may or may not be true. I have a job. I had to get a fingerprint clearance, and they were fingerprinting me. I fingerprint really, really well. I know, you know, not to put a lot of pressure, to roll gently and go with the fingerprinter, and... they were fingerprinting me for this clearance, and I didn't want to raise any red flags, so I looked at the woman, and I sort of very calmly said, well, how far back are you going to check? And she looked me in the eye and said, from the day you were born. And I thought, whoa, it's kind of like a fifth step, only it's in the wrong order, because they're going to know about it before I do. And I'm going to tell you, once that report came back, I know a lot more about my story after I read that report than I did before I was fingerprinted. So, like I said, I was a blackout drinker. I love blackouts. I don't understand people who are sitting in a bar drinking and they look at their watch and it's 9:15 and next thing they know it's 1:00 in the morning and they don't know where the time went and they panic and they come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and they're sweating and they're nervous and they're like sharing the story about losing 5 hours and they don't know where the time went and they know their life's unmanageable and they have to come to AA. I don't understand that. I love blackouts. For me, there was nothing more exciting than leaving work on September 12th, going back to work on September 20th, and discovering I'd been there the entire time. I wish we could have blackout sober. It makes the time between paychecks so much shorter, but... being a blackout drinker, there's a lot of what it used to be like that just is not, I just am not sure of yet, but... I didn't have my first drink of alcohol until I was 13 years old. I'm really sorry I waited that long, but I didn't have any idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I never really thought about drinking one way or another. I didn't think I would ever drink, or I didn't think I would never drink. I just don't remember ever having a conscious thought one way or another about alcohol. And yet when I was 13 years old, I was on a camping trip with a group of girls. We were camped at the beach just south of Oceanside in Southern California. And I remember getting into the tent that Friday night, and I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And to this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I believe it was the grace of God, but I've never been sure about that. But I took the bottle out of my pillowcase, and I remember being excited about having it. And I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around the tent, and nothing had gotten different, and nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle, and that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous was I heard you talk about your first drink. And you talked about taking the drink, and you felt it, the warmth in your mouth. And you somehow felt the warmth as it went down your throat, and you felt it as it went down and hit your stomach, and it hit your stomach, and you talked about it exploding and going to your fingernails and your toenails, and your pimples fell off, and you grew a few inches, and you dropped about 20 pounds, and you became Prince Charles and Lady Di, and wonderful things happened to you. And that wasn't my story. I mean... I had my first drink of alcohol, and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me was I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief this morning that if you were to drink a quart of anything in about 15 minutes, you would have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent, and I shuffled down to the outhouse, and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely and totally 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move. I mean, I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Later in my drinking, I did discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time. But the second person has to be very careful about what they're doing, but... I didn't know that at 13, and so I sat there in terror. And I don't know how I knew this, but I somehow knew that the body was made up of energy, and I somehow figured that if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. And so I suppose it was my first formal meditation, because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, when it seemed to be kind of all balled up, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, of course, I've discovered that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy. I was in the Marines. I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. Now, in my own defense, I always have to tell you that my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I've always said under those circumstances it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either. So I got out of there. And that was my first drink of alcohol. And it was the most wonderful, incredible, marvelous, magnificent, spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I remember the day the guy at the market called me over and he said, "Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore." He said, "I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do." And And I got cut off from that supply. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I mean, I still have a problem. If you're wearing Taboo, I may follow you too closely and lap at your neck. I'm often tempted when I introduce myself to say I'm Patty and I'm a pig. I'm the person that came to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom. And I don't know, this is unusual. I don't know there's anything strange with this. I don't know that this is bizarre behavior. And how would I know? I mean, how would I know? I'm a bar drinker. I drank living rooms, cars, alleys, dumpsters, offices. I mean, I didn't specialize, but I love bars. And I love sleazy, sleazy bars. I mean, the really sleazy, nasty ones with the sawdust on the floor. I like them when the mirrors are cracked, so you kind of have to dip around to see yourself in there. The upholstery around the bar is ripped, where people have tried to hold on as they're falling off their bar stool. And they're full of smoke, and they have that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still. I love that smell. But what fascinates me is the quality of people that were in those sleazy. I mean, they're really sleazy bars with some really high class people. CEOs of big companies, bank presidents, neurosurgeons, pilots in the Air Force. I mean, that's what they said they were. I never told a lie in the bar. But we weren't sitting around those bars having conversations like, well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? Well, what's your preference, Chantilly or Aqua Velva? We weren't having those kinds of conversations, so it doesn't occur to me I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old, I put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on, I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State. I graduated from San Diego State with a 3.8 grade point average. I'm a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I'm drinking on a daily basis, and I graduate from college with a 3.8 grade point average. So I stayed in San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I mean, when I'm one of those people, if I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it. And I seem to do school just fine. So I stayed and took classes for a master's degree. And I left San Diego. I was offered a job in Chico, California, which is Northern California, about as far north as you can get. And I took the job, and I loaded my car. I put everything I owned in my car. I took two cases of beer, two bottles of booze, and I headed north. I got to Santa Ana, which is about 80 miles north of San Diego. I was out of booze and I was thirsty. So I pulled off the freeway. I have a sense I can find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. It was full of smoke. It had that wonderful used booze urine smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox and I knew I was home. I sat down, ordered a drink, and that's as far north as I ever got. 80 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my lover, my friend, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned, and I believe it was in the middle of my first drink, but at some point it had turned and began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, honesty, integrity, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. And by the time I got here, it had taken it all, but alcohol controlled my life from the very beginning, where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from. And I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I got a job in the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top. And that almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I got here, I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the big oak desk I sat behind. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about was I was in the newspaper business, and we often gave awards. And I know this morning, and because God gave me a gift, we often won awards. But I didn't tell you about the time that I would be behind a podium much like this in a room full of people. I would come out of a blackout holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you about that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I was in the newspaper business, and if you're in that business, you have to drink. I mean, you have to drink. You work really long hours, 8, 10, 12-hour day work day, and then you have to go to the bar because that's where the news was. That's where the leads happened. That's where the big stories broke. And I know a lot of nights I didn't even want to go to the bar, but I had to do it. I mean, it was part of my job. And Since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that if you work for May Company, you have to go to the bar after work. And if you work at the gas station, you have to go to the bar after. If you're unemployed, you have to go to the bar after. But I didn't know that then. I mean, I have a disease that manifests itself in rationalization, justification, and denial, only I don't know I have a disease. And I have to go to the bar. I have to work hard, and then I have to go to the bar. And I have to tell you, I did get a lot of leads in the bars. Now, the problem was is I would write the notes on those stupid little napkins, and then my glass would sweat, and then the ink would run. And then in the morning, I'd look at that napkin, and it'd be all this. I couldn't read it, and I'm going, oh, my God, I can't read. Geez, I hope that guy's there again tonight. I have to get this information. I'd have to go back again. And I did break a really big story. One of our local school board guys, a married man with six children, was having an affair, which used to be big news. Now it's almost required. But I broke this really big story about this extramarital affair he was having, and it was really big news. Now, never once during that time did it ever occur to me I was the woman he was having an affair with. If you suffer from alcoholism, it misses some brain cells sometimes. One night I left the bar. I was on my way home. I think all the time. I mean, I've always been a thinker. I still am a thinker. And I'm driving home from the bar thinking about something, and I turned left onto my street. And just as I turned left onto my street, my power steering went out. And I slammed into this car parked on the left-hand side of the street. And, of course, I panicked. I turned the wheel a little to the right, and I slammed into the car on the right. And turned a little to the left, and I slammed into a car on the left, and I slammed into one on the right, and I finally pulled into my driveway, and I was so grateful that I'd gotten home safely. I just sat there in a moment of gratitude before I went in the house, and I go in the house, and I'm not in the house but a minute or two, and the doorbell rings. I look at my watch. It is 20 after 2 in the morning. Who is looking for me now? People are always wanting something from you. They never leave you alone. There's always somebody wanting something, but, geez, it's 20 after 2, and I go open the door, and it's the Orange County Sheriff. I said, what do you want? Do you know what time it is? And he wanted me to come out on the front yard, so I start telling him about my car. Apparently, it wasn't mechanical. He didn't care about my car. He points down the street to all these cars that are just smashed all up and down the street. And I looked at him and said, and isn't it great I got home safely? I mean, he opened the back door of his car. He wanted me to get in. I think he wants me to go on the ride-along. I mean, I don't have time to go on the ride-along. I'm explaining to him, I don't have time. I got a 7 a.m. meeting. I got to get some sleep. I've been on the ride-along. I know your route. I know your job. I know what you do. I don't have time tonight. And he was insisting I get in the car, and I'm telling him I can't. He's insisting I do. And I thought, well, the guy's going to either, he's not going to leave me alone. I better just go on the ride-along so he can bring me home. I can go to bed. So I hop in the car. Now, I have a reputation in Orange County as a violent drunk, only I don't know it. I don't know I have a reputation. And how would I know? I mean, this is, you tell me. I'm driving down the street. The light comes on behind me. Now I know what it means. It means pull over. There are people in AA who think that means put the pedal to the metal and take off like a bat out of hell. But I know it means pull over. So I pull over, and the officer comes up to the door. Now, the first thing I do is slam the car door open. Now, my intent is to knock him in the private parts. But men are really kind of fussy about their private parts, so as the door's flying open, he jumps backwards. And when he jumps further away, it's really a good thing, because now he's far enough away I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, this looks like a fair fight. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I go out the car for him. Now, it's a pretty good fight. I was a lot younger then, but it's a pretty good fight for a minute or two. But I never considered the fact that he's got a friend back at his car. And the friend has a radio, and the friend calls some more friends. And pretty soon it's four or five of them, one of me. Well, even I know it's not fair anymore, and I say, Uncle. Next time the light comes on behind me, I pull over. The officer walks up. I slam my car door open, try and knock him in the private parts. He jumps back. I get him in focus. I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me. I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try to go out the car for him. And it's a good fight for a minute or two. I don't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friends. Pretty soon it's five or six of them, one of me. Well, not fair, I say uncle. And I don't do that once or twice. I do that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over. And I think the results are going to be different. I never remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friends. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came here and discovered you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I never knew that. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. They don't care that they won the fight. Drunk driving assault, drunk driving assault, drunk driving assault. And when you get out of the car that way, you get a reputation as a violent drunk, only I don't know it. So when the officer, when I hop in the back seat for the ride along that morning, he shackles my ankles and he cuffs my hands behind my back. And in Orange County, our sheriff, I don't know why, but they have this fence between the front seat and the back seat. And he starts taking me on the ride along, and I'm asking him questions like, are we going on your regular route? Well, what is it we're looking for tonight? How's your night been? You been busy? We're... And he's not responding to me. I start talking some more, and he won't answer me. And I'm asking him some more questions, and he's not responding. Next thing I know, we're on the freeway. Well, the ride along, when you take somebody on a ride along, you don't take them on the freeway. And I'm trying to tell him, you're not supposed to be on the freeway. You're supposed to be on your regular route. And what are we doing and where are you going? And he wouldn't talk to me. And so I don't know about it. The devil flew in me. I don't know if the devil ever flew into you, but the devil flew into me that morning. I just honked up a big one. I just spit right on the back of his head. See, you think it's kind of amusing. He wasn't entertained at all. In fact, he sped up. And he's going faster and faster and faster. And now he's in a really big hurry. And when the speedometer hit 100 miles an hour, he slammed on the brakes. Now I'm shackled and I'm cuffed and I can't break the fall, and I went face forward into that metal grate. My glasses broke, there was blood everywhere, it was a mess. But I'll never forget that morning when they were taking my mugshot. They kept referring to me as Waffle Face because I had that. And that's how it went, over and over and over and over. Never once did it occur to me it had anything to do with alcohol. It was you and they and them. It was the cops. It was circumstances and conditions. It was pressure. It was a lot of stuff, but it never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. My disease manifests itself in such a way that regardless of what happens to me, I explain it to you why it had to be that way. And as I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. And as I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. Justification, rationalization, and denial. What I pray God was my last drunk driving assault charge. I'm very anal. I'm the kind of person, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report, and I read it. I find out where I made my mistake so that next time I can do that part right. And I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time. So I had practiced field sobriety tests a lot. I am really, really good at field sobriety tests. And on what I pray God was my last drunk driving assault, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I had just confessed, and they... So on the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around. You think it was funny? He didn't. Took me to Orange County Jail and put me in a cell with criminals. I went to court on that charge, and I was 26 years old. I stood in the courtroom that morning drunk. It's the only way I went to court. It's the only way I went to the laundromat, the grocery store, school, work. It's the only way I did anything. I stood there drunk that morning. Because of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed. The tone of his voice got different. And he looked at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance. And he offered me a program, and part of that program was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I wish I could tell you that I took the alternative. I came here. I worked the 12 steps in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. And sometimes when there's nobody in the room that knows me, that is a story I tell. But that's not my story. I stood in the courtroom and thought about it. 10 years program, 10 years alternative. I'm trying to make a decision. I got the public defender putting his elbow in my ribs, and I'm trying to think about it. I'm trying to weigh it out. I've been to jail. I know how to do jail. There's more alcohol and other drugs inside the institution than there are some days on the street. If you know what to do, who to do it to, and you're willing to go to any length, and I always was. So I'm thinking, alternative prison, alternative prison. And I had that morning what I know this morning was a moment of clarity. because standing there trying to make that decision, I knew, as clear as I had known anything up until that day, I knew that if I went to jail one more time, I would either die in the institution or become institutionalized for life. And I didn't know why I knew it that morning, but I knew it. So I took the alternative. I left the courtroom and I drank for 3 more months. I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol, but I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what ANA was. I thought it was something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners, and, well, a lot of days it is, but as far as I know, I had never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous before. I didn't know what you people were going to do to me or for me. I had no idea what this was. And it was a Sunday night. It was a speaker meeting. There were about 200 people in the meeting. And I can't tell you who talked that night, but I heard two things. I heard, we don't drink between meetings. I looked around the room, and I didn't see any of you drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? It made me really nervous. I don't know how it affects other people, but it really made me nervous. The other thing I heard that night was the answers were in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. I can't tell you how I went home and read it. I can't tell you how irritated I was. Not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I'm a thief. I don't know I'm a thief. I had to stay sober a while and have my sponsor tell me I'm a thief. And I think it's really critical you have a sponsor. I think it's really important you have a sponsor who's not as emotionally involved in your life as you are. It irritates me sometimes, but she has a whole different perspective of my life. And she thinks I'm a thief. And you tell me what you think. I'm in a bar drinking. The bar closes. I pick up some keys off the bar. I go find the car that they fit, and I'm driving myself home. My sponsor and the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. I just need to get home. But I'm a thief and I've stolen the wrong book. And before I go back to court to tell the judge that he made a horrible error, I didn't understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. I would have understood if he sent me to the Sears School of Safe Driving. I didn't understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink, and I was going to go back and tell him he'd made a horrible mistake. But before I went back, I wanted to get the answer book. So Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I came to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. I mean, look at the person next to you. Unless you're sleeping with them, what is it? I mean, and then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants, not like the kids do today. I don't know about Hawaii. I haven't seen too many young people. I work with teenagers, and these kids wear pants that have absolutely no relationship to their body size. They wear pants. I'm forever telling them they could put a homeless family in there with them. His pants weren't that baggy, but they were baggy. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, and the holes were there where they should have been, and he nodded out during the meeting. Now, I quickly figured it out. He was shooting heroin, because folks who shoot heroin nod out. And I could probably do this thing and not drink if I could shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked, and the next day I snuck down to his office, and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, he said, I'll guarantee you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my family life would get better, my relationships would get better, my job life would get better, my finances would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. So it's a little hope for the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here this morning, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. You see, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going through something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I'm going through something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. I don't know good from bad for me. I've gone through times in my sobriety where seemingly my whole life is falling apart. I've gone through times sober where I have lost everything I've worked for. I have lost relationships. I've lost jobs. I've lost stuff. And it seems to me in those times, because I'm so dramatic, I always refer to them as the dark night of the soul. It seems to me in those times that God just sort of brought me this far and then took off to tend to one of you and ignored me. And in those times, I don't drink and I don't die, and I don't drink and I don't die, and I don't drink and I don't die. And I get far enough beyond it to, in retrospect, see that it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where He'd have me be. And every time I have thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to, I don't let go easily. Everything that's been removed from me has claw marks on it. I don't let go easy. I get in a rut, I decorate it. I mean, But God has a plan, and every time that I have gone through something that I thought was bad, it's turned out to be good. And I don't know why I believed that old man. I hadn't believed a human being in a very long time. My perception of my life may or may not be true. My perception of my life is that people hurt me all my life. People disappointed me and they let me down. They weren't there for me. They told me they would be there and they weren't. My parents told me they loved me anymore. Their love and I'd have died. Their love was physically, emotionally, and mentally abusive. As a small child, I'd made a decision to never love another human being. As a small child, I began to build a wall to keep you out because I just didn't want to be hurt anymore. And I had built a big brick wall between me and you. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out and play. Alcohol just made it okay for me to be back there. And when you have a big brick wall built between you and the rest of the world, you don't believe anybody and you don't trust anybody. So I don't know why I believed that old man that morning, but I believed him. And I need to tell you, that old man that I thought was shooting heroin, in reality, was sober longer than I'd been alive. And the reason he nodded out in meetings is he had a peace inside. He had a rightness inside. He was right with us, he was right with God, and he was right with himself. And I didn't have a clue as to what that was about. But I already had the book, so every night I'd open the book and I'd read, "Most of us are unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics." I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. I would go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee. I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty, and that was talking to another alcoholic. My core program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive, but I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail. So I went to the 2 meetings a week my core program said I had to go to, and the only thing I did right is I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And God bless the people in Alcoholics Anonymous when I walked in, because I was not a kind newcomer. I was not the kind of newcomer that you ever want to see come into your meetings. People would come up to me to give me their phone numbers. I would kick at you, spit at you, take a swing at you. Somebody would be sharing in a meeting. They'd irritate me. I'd throw my chair at them. This is not the bedrock of mental health, but eventually people weren't coming up to me anymore. Pretty soon the only people coming up to me was if your sponsor was annoyed with you, he or she would point to me and say, "See that woman over there? Go give her your phone number." And being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you would try to do that. And one night a guy was sharing. He didn't say anything to me. I just took it personally. And after the meeting, I jumped him and I was beating his head into the concrete floor. And it took 6 guys to get me off of him. And when they did, I knew they were going to throw me away. See, I kept thinking I had to get thrown out of AA. It never occurred to me to just leave. I thought they were going to throw me away. And when they got me off of him, one of those men looked at me and he said, "Patty, next time you feel that volcano," he said, "just put your hands in your pockets and don't touch another alcoholic." And I wondered how he knew about the volcano. Nobody had ever talked to me about the volcano before, but that's what I had inside of me. I had a volcano inside of me. And when it erupted, I had to do something. When it erupted, I wanted to see blood, preferably yours. When it erupted, I didn't seem to have a choice. And Alex told me just to put my hands in my pockets and not touch another human being. And I had to walk around Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time with my hands in my pockets to discover that that anger was a cover for a tremendous amount of fear. I was absolutely scared to death. I was afraid of you. I was afraid of life. I was afraid of me. And I had survived in places where you can't survive if you're afraid. And so I'd covered that fear with anger, and by the time I got here, I acted it out in violence. And all you ever said to me was, "Keep coming back." and I'd wave my court card in your face and tell you I didn't have a choice, and I'd sit down until the next time, and or the next time. And one night I heard the traditions read. Now, I know now they read them at every meeting, but I don't know what I was doing then, not listening to them. But the third tradition, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I was so excited, I leapt out of my chair. I said, that's it. I don't have a desire to stop drinking. I want to drink more than I want to breathe. I can't stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started to leave. And an old-timer grabbed me, and thank God for the old-timers, and this guy grabbed a hold of me, and he said, Patty, he said, there's a judge in South Orange County Court. He has a desire for you to stop drinking, and in your case, we're going to let that be enough. So I stayed on somebody else's desire. I don't think it matters whose desire you're here on. I don't think it matters what your motive is. I think what's important is that you're here. There's no chapter in the book into motive. There's no chapter in the book into desire. There's no chapter in the book into thinking. And there's no chapter in the book into feeling. The chapter is into action. And I think what's important is that we're here. And I kept coming back, and I kept coming back, and I kept coming back. And I pray God happens to everybody who's new what happened to me. 8.5 months away from my last drink, I was in a pain that I had never been in before or since. I've been in a lot of pain sober. I don't know why I thought. I think all the time, you know, and I make up stuff. I don't get input from anybody. I just make it up. And one of the things I thought, listening to you, I thought that if I, like, really did this program, if I really, really worked the steps, if I really put a lot of passion into the steps, that I would somehow skyrocket above any feeling that I judged as negative. I would never, like, be afraid or have insecurity or self-doubt. Nothing bad would ever happen to me. I just somehow figured I'd just kind of scoot along up here. And the truth for me in working the steps is I've come into my humanness. And as a human being, I have fear, I have insecurity, I have self-doubt, and life sometimes is painful. The difference between now and then is that you give me the courage and strength that I need to continue to choose to recover through the pain of my life. So I've had painful times in the last 25 years, but I have never been in the kind of pain that I was in 8.5 months away from my last drink. The pain of not drinking and not recovering. The pain of not drinking and not recovering for me is the greatest pain I've ever been in. And in that pain at 8.5 months away from my last drink, I fell to my knees and I took the first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I admit in my life that I was powerless over alcohol. Whenever I ingest alcohol, I'm damned to live the same way over and over and over. When I drink alcohol, I have no choices. When I drink alcohol, alcohol controls every area of my life. What I do and who I do it with is controlled by alcohol, and I have no choices. And that was my powerlessness, and that was my unmanageability, and it took 8.5 months of not drinking to see the evidence. You all saw it when I came in, but you gave me the dignity to do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it, until I got far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. I wish I could tell you then. I looked at the rest of the 11 steps. I knew they were the solution to the problems of my life. I worked them all in a day and a half and skyrocketed to recovery, but the truth for me is I've never worked any of the steps, so my back was against the wall. The pain was so great it was do or die, and I had no other choice. Under those circumstances, I become very willing to work the next one of the 12 steps to recovery. And that's what I want to talk about for a few minutes is the steps, because there is no way to get from where I was on October 4th, 1975, to where I am this morning except for the power and the magic of the 12 steps to recovery. There is no way to get here. And this is just my experience with the steps. If you have a different experience, talk to your sponsor after the meeting. This is my experience. I'm having the most major hot flash standing up here. I just want to tell you that right now. No booze is one thing, but no booze and no estrogen is a killer. Whew. My. I usually start undressing when I have one of these, but Since it is a spiritual meeting, I'll leave my clothes on. Step two for me, I have one problem with God. I believe we are all God's children, and I've always wanted to be an only child. That's the only problem I have with God. But I'm a loner by nature. Left to my own, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't change your nature. What Alcoholics Anonymous does for me is it gives me the courage and strength that I need to do the things in spite of my nature. I'm a loner by nature. The most difficult thing for me to do is to be here with you. My preference is to be home on my couch. The most difficult thing is to be here with you, and I don't know why God gave me this gift. I believe we all have gifts, and I think we need to honor and cherish our gifts. God gave me the gift of being able to run my mouth. My preference would be is my job Monday night at my step study meeting of making coffee. That's my, because I do it by myself. That's my preference. But this is the gift God gave me, and I need to honor it. But it's the most difficult thing that I do is to come be here with you. But you give me the courage and strength to do the things I need to do in spite of my nature. You know you're a loner if you don't like AA potlucks. That's generally the indicator. That's generally the indicator of a loner. But being a loner, if I had come to believe God was going to restore me to sanity, I would have sat on my couch. God would have flown in, sprinkled me with sanity, taken off to wherever it is God hangs out, and that would have been the end of it. I would have never had to do another thing. So for me, I came to believe that the power greater than myself was the actions, the steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, that somehow through taking the action, the steps, I would be restored to sanity. And for me, sanity is how I think. I think all the time. Don't get me wrong here. I think all the time. I'm talking to you, I'm already thinking about something else. Then I start thinking about the fact that I'm thinking. Then I start thinking I shouldn't be thinking what I'm thinking that I'm thinking while I'm thinking. And then I try not to think about what I'm thinking while I'm thinking it that I shouldn't be thinking. And I'll tell you what, I am grateful. I am so grateful I don't have a loudspeaker on my head. So that everything I thought came barreling out. I mean, that would be truly humiliating, but I think all the time. Now what I've discovered is that my thinking is just a little skewed from the rest of the world. My thinking is just a little different than the rest of the world. And I came to believe that through taking the actions, the steps, my thinking would somehow be in line with the rest of the world. I'm an alcoholic. I suffer from alcoholism. I don't suffer from alcoholism. I suffer from alcoholism. I'm as alcoholic today as I was the day before I came to you. I have alcoholism. And so every once in a while I have a thought that a drink would be nice. When I have that thought, I clap, I say thank you for your participation, I just go about whatever it is that I'm doing. And I don't have to take an action on it, and I don't have to beat myself up for having it. And that's what I came to believe would happen in step two, was that to taking the action, the steps, my thinking would somehow be in line with the rest of the world. I looked at step three. Every once in a while you ask somebody, what step are you on? They go, well, I'm on the third step, you know. Every day I get up and I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, but by about noon I take it back. Well, I'm on step three, you know, every day I'm turning my will and my life over to God, except, oh, for my sex and finances, because I don't want to be poor and celibate. And I pretty much stay away from those folks, because I don't think they understand the step. I work in Orange, California, and I go the same way to work every day, and I'm driving up Chapman Avenue in Orange to go to work, and I get to this intersection, I got to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. To get to my job, I got to turn right, so I make a decision to turn right, and I go straight through the intersection. So I make a U-turn, I'm coming back to the intersection, I got to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. Now to get to my job, I got to turn left, so I make a decision, turn left, and I go straight through the intersection. So I make another U-turn, I'm going back to the intersection, I got to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. Now to get to my job, I got to turn right, I make a decision, turn right, I go straight through the intersection. Now I'm like irritated, and I'm making a U-turn, I'm coming back, and I got to make a decision, right, left, or go straight. To get to my job, I got to turn left, I make a decision to turn left, I take the steering wheel, and I do this. And it says it in the book. It says, although our decision was vital, it had very little permanent effect unless immediately followed by action. The decision I make coming up to that intersection has no impact on my car. The only thing that has impact on my car is turning the steering wheel. If I had never taken an action, I would still be making U-turns up and down Chapman Avenue in Orange, and somebody else would be here sharing their inexperience, weakness, and despair with you this morning. So step three said to me, make a decision. How do you want to live? Chronic, hopeless, helpless, alcoholic, or do you want to believe the people in AA are telling you the truth? Incomprehensible demoralization and despair or hope? It's not a difficult decision. I think I'll go with hope. But the decision has no impact on my life. The decision didn't change my life at all. What began to change my life was the action of step four. Now, I, of course, didn't have to do it. Now, I know all you do, but I'm a journalist by training. Of course, I've drank myself out of my profession of choice. I have given everything up to alcohol, including the only thing I wanted to do for a living since I was in the fourth grade. I drank it away. I've given up my profession. To this day, I can't work in the newspaper business in Orange County. But I'm a trained writer, and I figure writing this inventory was for those of you who had very little creative writing skills. Those of you who aren't writers probably need to write this inventory just to brush up on your creative writing skills, but I didn't need to do it, and I didn't do it, and I didn't do it, and I didn't do it. And then something happened to me. I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in pain. I sat in the middle of you and felt isolated and alone. I felt different. I felt unique. I knew there was no sense sharing. You weren't going to understand anyway, and I left in more pain than I came in with. And I came back the next night in pain and sat in the middle of you and felt different and unique. I knew there was no sense sharing. You weren't going to understand. And I left in more pain than I came in with. And I did that night after night after night until the pain of being with you was so great that I knew I would have to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't stay here in the kind of pain that I was in. And on my way out of the meeting that night, I had one of my thoughts. And the thought was, before you leave Alcoholics Anonymous, why don't you try writing an inventory? So I went home and I opened the book to where it talks about the fourth step, the only part where it breaks text, the little diagram. I made the columns. I wrote down who I resented, which basically turned out to be everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine. I wrote down in the second column what they did to me. Well, I've wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. Wrote down in the third column how it affected me. Well, it affected my self-esteem, my self-worth. I was really having a good time. I was sorry I waited so long to do this. And I was just writing away. And then in my zealousness, I accidentally turned the page to the big book. Well, after the diagram hidden in the body of the text, it says, referring to our list again, we put out of our minds the wrongs others had done. And we looked at our part. Well, now it wasn't any fun anymore, but I did that. I did that with my resentments, my fears, and my relationships. And for the first time in my life, I saw who Patio was. You see, I'd spent my whole life putting on a show for you. My whole life, justification, rationalization, and denial. My whole life was a show for you. And I came to believe the show. And when I did my fourth step, I saw who Patio really was. And then I looked at the fifth step and thought it was really, really a nice thing for those. I'm raised Catholic. And I thought it was a good thing for those of you who aren't raised Catholic to do, because those of us who are Catholic, we know about confession and we know it doesn't work. And I figured sharing in the fifth step would give the rest of you the experience that we had. So I put my fourth step in the trunk of my car. And I drove around with a sense of impending doom. And, of course, the fear was as I was going to get rear-ended on the freeway, my trunk would fly open, my fourth step would be everywhere. And I told you I'm anal. I'd written my first and last name on every page of that fourth step. But instead of doing the fifth step, I just chose to drive around that way for a very long time. And then one night I was in Los Angeles visiting a friend of mine, and we were talking. And as we were talking, I realized I was doing a fifth step. And I thought, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. So I went to my car and I got my fourth step and I did my fifth step with her. And after I did my fifth step, that big brick wall that I had built between me and you, that wall didn't crumble down. One brick came out of that wall. But every time I've shared with another human being, another brick has come out of that wall. And this morning I have no brick wall between me and you. Well, I have a little styrofoam thing I throw up sometimes because... Sometimes I get afraid. You know what, I had this reoccurring. When I was drinking, I would have this thought. I'd be driving to work, and I'd have this thought. Today's the day they're going to fire you. Today's the day they're going to find out you can't do this job. Today's the day they're going to call you in, and I would get really irritated when I'd have that thought. And I'd start swearing at them in my car. And I'd be really irritated, and I'd pull into a bar, and I'd go in and tell the bartender what a bunch of SOBs I used to work for, and how they don't even know how valuable I am, and their whole company is going to crumble and go to the toilet. And I'd order another drink and another drink and another drink, and I would never even get to work to get fired. I sometimes have that thought today. Sometimes I'm driving to work, and I have this thought. Today's the day they're going to fire. Today's the day they're going to call you in and say, you know what, we didn't mean to hire you. We meant to hire the other Patio. Today's the day. And the difference between now and then is I have you. And I call my sponsor. Now, I'm all wired up. I got phones. And I used to wear my garage door opener so I looked important, but now I got... Now I got all the electronics, and so I call my sponsor. Now, I don't know why, if it's her problem, it is very, very serious. If it's my problem, she laughs at me. So I call her up, and I tell her, and she laughs, and when she gets done laughing, she says, honey, you just go ahead and go to work. After they fire you, call me back. Oh, okay, and I go to work, and they don't call me in, and they don't fire me, and I that's the difference. The difference today is I have you. We can do what I can't. I absolutely cannot. I can't stay sober. I cannot do life. I cannot handle a feeling. I don't know what to do with an emotion. I don't know how to behave out there. But somehow we can. We can do what I can't. day after day after day after day, and I keep coming back to you for that. I don't know where that came from, but it was a good story, wasn't it? And so I went home from doing my fifth step, and I did my six and seven by mistake. I didn't mean to recover this quickly, but I accidentally, by coincidence, I opened the big book to the part where it talks about step six and seven. And you don't have to be a journalist to know this book is very poorly written. Any newcomer will tell you that. But that part around step six and seven gets kind of poetic, and I just kind of got lulled into reading it. When I became aware of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the seven-step prayer. Bye, Johnny and Karen, I love you. And when I became aware of what I was reading, that prayer took the longest journey anything has ever taken for me, the journey from my head to my heart. And I finished reading that prayer, and what it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I have been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. And I believe that's the miracle here. We tell people don't leave before the miracle happens, and then we don't tell them what the miracle is. I believe the miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous is that through working the steps, we have an opportunity to walk away from the person we've been all of our life and start to become the person God intended for us to be. And I think too many people leave before they give themselves that chance. The best I've ever described myself when I came here was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the steps work and because you've been willing to share with me, I've become very kind, very loving, very gentle, very caring, very nurturing. Of course, now they're telling me it's codependency and I have to recover from it, but I love the person who I am. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. And there is absolutely no fear that my character defects were ripped away from me and are free-floating in this room. You have no fear of catching one of my character defects. I believe, for me, my character defects are in this little red wagon that I pull around with me all the time. They were my survival tools. They were the tools that allowed me to stay alive long enough to get to you. And so God lets me keep them in my little red wagon. I pull them around with me all the time. Sometimes I get too afraid and you're not there. Sometimes I feel too insecure and you're not there. And sometimes I take one of those defects out of my wagon and I use it. And when I don't like the way it feels, not when you don't like the way it looks, but when I don't like the way it feels, all I need do is ask God to remove it, and he puts it back in my wagon. I had a job one time. I'm going to tell this story for my friend Stacy, who came here all the way from Phoenix, although her name badge says Newport Beach. I guess if you're from Phoenix, you would want to say you were from Newport Beach. I had a job one time where not because of me, but because of my job, I had to give this lecture one morning on spirituality, and I left my house late. But I'm one of those people, I think if I leave late, if I drive fast enough, I can get there on time. So I left late and I was driving fast, and there was a traffic jam in an area where there should not have been a traffic jam, and we just screeched to a halt. Now I'm already anxious because I'm late, and we move a little and we stop. And we move a little and we stop. And I'm getting more anxious because I'm getting more late. And we move and we stop. Well, the guy behind me lays on his horn. Now, I don't know where he thought I was going to go, except in the trunk of the car in front of me. But we move and we stop, he honks. We move and we stop, and he honks. I'm already anxious. I'm getting irritated. We move, we stop, he honks. I finally had it. I put the car in gear. I put the emergency brake on. I had my dress-up clothes and high heels. I jump out of my car and I head for his. Now, he had electric windows. He almost got them rolled up. He missed by about this much, though, just enough for me to get my arm in there. I got him by the collar of his shirt. I twisted it, and I pulled his little face to the window. And I started telling him about himself. I was telling him about his mother. I was suggesting he do things that I really think are physically impossible. Now, I'm sure he didn't like the way it looked long before I didn't like the way it felt, but all of a sudden, I took a breath. And in that breath, I realized that I'd picked that tool up from the wagon. In that breath, I realized I was behaving the way I behaved before I came to you. In that breath, I didn't like the way. Now, I wish I could tell you I let him go, but I didn't. I did loosen up enough, though, that the blood flowed back into his face. And I apologized for my behavior. I said, I believe every word I said to you, but I'm really sorry for how I did it. And I let him go, and he got his window up like that quick, and I got in my car, and we moved, and we stopped, and he didn't honk, and we moved. And I wish I could tell you, I was 12 years sober when I did that. But because this program works, because of step 6 and 7, because you've shared with me, I didn't have to beat myself up for doing that. I didn't have to run that tape that says you're a lousy member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're really no good, and it's all been a sham up until now. I didn't have to stop at a liquor store and buy a bottle. I didn't have to stop at a bar and get a drink and tell the bartender about this idiot that was behind me. In fact, I actually went off to where I was supposed to be and gave the best lecture on spirituality I've ever given. Because the steps work. Because the steps work. Steps 8 and 9 for me are conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. Everything went for one more drink. If it came between me and you and a drink, you went. If it came between a job and a drink, the job went. There were more jobs. There were more people. Everything was. If it came between anything and anything, the drink won. I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous talking about their list and saying, well, I need to put myself number one on the list. I want to tell you something. If I had put myself number one on the list, I would have never gotten to number two. Everything I did for me. Everybody I hurt for one more drink. And I felt guilty because I was guilty. And my amends for me were not just about saying sorry. I'd said sorry all my life. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I would do it again. And then I'd get caught. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I would do it again. And then I'd get caught. Sorry, sorry, sorry. I said sorry all my life. It wasn't about sorry for me. My amends for me were changing the way I lived. I always thought I came from a dysfunctional family. I found out I was the dysfunction. My family are just fine. I didn't know how to be a daughter. I didn't know how to be a sister. I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know how to be an employee. I didn't know how to live out there. And so I come here and you share with me. You shared with me how to be a daughter. You shared with me how to be a sister. You shared with everything that I've learned from you. And I'm so grateful for that. I began to make my amends. I began to live differently. I began being a good daughter and a good sister. But there was one amend I wasn't going to make. I wasn't going to make an amend to my father. I hated my father. My father is a drunk. My father's a Jekyll and Hyde drunk. My father was abusive, and I seemed to be the target of his abuse. I was physically abused by my father on a regular basis, and I absolutely refused to make amends to him. I hated him, and I wasn't going to make amends. And I told my sponsors, I'm not making amends to my father. I hate my father. She said, that's fine as long as you're willing to pay the price. I thought, what price? I don't have to see him. I don't care. I can pay it. And the condition I came in Alcoholics Anonymous was there were no people in my life. Now, I don't know if I don't like people. I'm still not sure. But I didn't have any friends in my life because who wants friends? I mean, friends are a nuisance. Friends, like, call you up and go, hey, where were you last night? And my response is, if I would have wanted you to know, I'd have called you before I went. They're, like, always, like, interfering and stuff. And who wanted them? I don't want friends in my life. They're, like, baggage. Who cares? But I've been sober for a while, and I'd seen you all having friends. And I started thinking, you know, it might not be bad. And so all of a sudden, I, like, had a friend. Now, my definition of a friend is the same person sits next to me at two meetings. They're, like, my friend now. And I got this friend. And I'm thinking, hey, this is pretty cool. I got a friend. But then my friend would do something annoying, like breathe too hard or crack her gum or something that annoyed me. Talk to the guy that I thought was God's will for me. I mean, something to annoy me. And now she couldn't be my friend anymore, but then I had, like, this friend now. I sat next to this person for two or three meetings, and now I got this friend. And I'm thinking, hey, got me a friend. And I'm, like, being kind of cocky about my friend. But then she did something to annoy me, and I couldn't tell you what, but it's like, well, now you can't be my friend, but, like, AA's, there's plenty of friends to be had, so I'm, like, picking new friends for a day or two, but I can't, like, be friends for very long, and I made the mistake of talking to my sponsor about it. Now, you really don't want to do this, because I don't know about it. I'll tell you how I sponsor. I love sponsoring women. I suggest they do stuff, and then I watch them, and if it works for them, then I try it, but... But I'm telling my, I'm not a whiner really, but I'm kind of telling my sponsor about how the women in AA are annoying me. I mean, Jesus, I'm trying to be friends with them, but they're driving me nuts. And my sponsor says to me, she says, you know what? She says, you hate your father. Now I'm thinking, what does this have to do with that? Yeah, I do. She said, hate does not know that it needs to stay directed at one person. You cannot hate one person and expect to have successful relationships in your life. Hate doesn't know that it stays directed at that person. Hate spills over into every relationship in your life. So I became willing to make amends to my father, not because I wanted to go to the father-daughter banquet, not because I wanted to have a father in my life. I became willing to make amends to my father because I wanted to have successful relationships with you. It doesn't matter what my motive is. What matters is what my action is. And I began to make amends to my father. I wrote him, I sent him cards at holidays and on his birthday. I would send him pictures of family gatherings that he wasn't invited to because he's such a goof. And I started doing those things. And my father became ill not too long ago, and he'd been diagnosed with cancer several years ago. And I'm not medical, so I don't know how this happens. But somehow through the treatment for his cancer, he broke his back. And he was in a convalescent hospital not far from where I live, and he would never get out of that bed. I mean, he will be in that bed until he dies, and he can't move. And I went up to see him. And I don't know why I went, because I didn't plan to go, but I went to see him, and we didn't have any big, long conversation. I mean, we talked about Nick at Night or whatever was on television, and I gave him a kiss before I left, and I told him that I'll be back Monday. Why did I say that? I don't want to be back Monday. This was like most I could endure this last 15 minutes. I don't want to be back Monday. God will do for me what I cannot or will not do for myself. God won't do for me what I can do for myself. I mean, I keep thinking God should send me money in the mail. I am capable of going to work. God will not send me money in the mail because I am capable of going to work. God won't do for me what I can do for myself, but God will do for me what I cannot or will not do for myself. And I told my dad I'd see him Monday. And I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that when I make a commitment, I show up. You have taught me through service to be responsible. You have taught me through your experience that when I say something, that it's the truth and I will do it. So I had told him I'd see him Monday, and boy, I didn't want... Over the weekend, I was out of town, and my brothers and my father took a turn for the worse, and all my brothers and sisters, there's a gaggle of us, they all came in, and they were with my father, and they kept calling me and telling me I needed to come, that the doctors kept saying he's not going to live through the night, and I was out of state. I kept saying, I can't come. I told Dad I'd be there Monday. I'll be there Monday. And so Monday I went, and my father survived the weekend. I walked into his room Monday. First thing I did was ask him for some of his morphine, but... I mean, my family knows I'm sober. They think it's a phase I'm going through. It's a long phase, but... And he hadn't responded at all weekend. He had not smiled, laughed, talked all weekend. And when I asked him for his morphine, he laughed. And I visited with him for a few minutes, and on my way out, I kissed him, and I told him I loved him. And I had never told my father I loved him. And I told him that I loved him. And I said, but, Dad, you know what? You need to leave the nurses alone. I mean, they're complaining that every time they come in here, you're patting them on the butt. And my father couldn't move, and he hadn't responded, and he laughed again. And he laughed. He didn't just smile. And I walked out of his room, and later that day, he passed away. And I was able to share that experience with my brothers and sisters. You see, I came here, and you taught me that it's about sharing my experience, strength, and hope, not just with you. But I shared that experience of my last visit with my father, with my brothers and sisters, because their last experience with their father was that he had laid in a bed, and he hadn't been able to move, and he hadn't responded. And so I was able to share my experience with them and change for them how they were feeling about his passing away. And I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous for that. I came here to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And I have gotten so much more as a result of working the steps and you sharing with me how to live out there. I have gotten so much more. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are the recovery steps. They're the steps that keep me moving up the down escalator. And you could try it out here. I tried it yesterday. Every once in a while I like to experiment with this to see how it works, because I'm the kind of person, I go to the May company and I go in on the first floor, but I'm really pretty lazy. I want to go to the second floor, but because I'm lazy, I go immediately to the escalator. Now, I always go to the escalator that's going down. You can get from the first floor to the second floor on the down escalator, but you got to keep moving. And that's what 10, 11, and 12 are. They keep me moving up the down escalator. If I stop using them, I don't hit bottom right away, but if I don't start using them, eventually I'm right back to where I was when I started. So they keep me moving up the down escalator. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it. Ask God to remove the defect. make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? It seems to me that when I'm focused on my problem, when I'm like really, really focused and really, really working on my problem, God can't do a thing with it. But when I ignore my problem for a moment to be of service to you, God can come in and take care of it. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? Step 11 for me, I'm a simple person. My prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. And I am so naive that I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My job is to not drink, show up, and live life to the fullest. The rest of the day is God's business. My prayer at night is a little scarier, and I offer it to anybody who would like to use it. My prayer at night is, dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. When I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will keep me from yelling at the lady at United Airlines who doesn't have my frequent flyer mile number. It will keep me from flipping off the guy on the freeway who cuts me off. It will keep me from yelling at the clerk at the grocery store that didn't she see the person in front of me had 12 items in the 10-item or less line. When I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. Step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me. The opportunity to take a little bit of this and give it to another alcoholic. To look into the eyes of another alcoholic and say, honey, take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to live that way a day at a time. I've done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I like to share that because sometimes I hear my story and I think, they're going to be calling me St. Patio here in a minute. So I'd like to let you know that I have done everything wrong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've slept with newcomers. I'd do it again in a minute if I had a chance. I mean, look at, we tell new people they're the most important person in the room and then we ignore them for a year. I mean, that's... I'm very judgmental. I have learned, however, in painfully, I'm not nearly as judgmental as I used to. My experience is the minute I make a judgment, that thing is going to happen to me in about 7 seconds. So I'm not nearly as, but I still am judgmental. I love gossip. I can hardly wait to hear gossip. If I don't hear enough gossip, I make some up. I mean, I love gossip. One time I charged for a 12-step call. I was visiting my mother. My amends to my mother was that I had to learn how to be a daughter and learn how to be a daughter. I needed to go to my mother's house every Sunday. I went to my mother's house almost every Sunday for 15 years before I got right with my mother. But I was visiting my mother one Sunday, and I got a call from a woman in AA, and she was going on a 12-step call and asked me to go, so I went. And it was, if money could keep you sober, this woman would never have had a problem. It took us, I honest to God, a quarter of a tank of gas to get from the street up her driveway just to get to her house. And she had a big old oak door, and oak's very expensive. And it was cracked open, and we went in, and the woman, the drunk, came down this spiral staircase, and she had on this, oh my God, this gown that was full of wine and puke, and she came sailing down there, and I sent the other woman in to make coffee, and I looked at this woman, and I said, you know what, I understand. This woman had been in and out of AA, in and out, in and out, in and out, could not stay sober. I said, I understand why you can't stay sober, and it's really not your fault. The reason you can't stay sober is the people in this town won't tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I can't just tell you the secret, because I live in a different county, so it would be against AA rules to just tell you the secret, but for $100, well... I should have asked her more because she pulled $100 out of her gown and without even blinking. And I put the money in my pocket and I told her the secret to Alcoholics Anonymous is if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And then the woman that was making coffee came out and I looked at her and I said, we don't need to be here anymore. And we left. And when that woman took a cake for 1 year of sobriety, I gave her, well, I didn't give her back her $100, but I gave her back the $100. And never once in that year did she ever tell anybody I charged her for that 12-step call. And I need to tell you, I talked to that lady about a week ago on her 18th birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I've gotten a lot of gifts since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and whenever I get one, I share about it because it's like the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I share about the gifts that I've gotten in life as a result of working the steps. The gifts happen to me in life. as a result of working the steps and hanging out with you and you teaching me how to live life. And I've gotten some tremendous gifts in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And whenever one happens to me, I share it with you. And it's always like when I share it, it's like the best thing that's ever happened to me. And honest to God, it is. It's always the best thing that's ever happened to me. And because it's your gift. It's not. I just am the recipient, but it's your gift. And I always feel I have a responsibility to share that gift with you. when I was, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had my son as a direct result of my alcoholism. And my son was 11 months old when I came to you, and I didn't know what to do with him, so I brought him with me to meetings. And you would take him and hold him and da-da-da-da-da, and you taught him how to love and how to be kind and how to be considerate. And I couldn't teach him those things. I didn't know any of that stuff. But everything he's learned from you. You also taught him how to con and manipulate. I'm a little upset about that, but I guess you have to take the good with the bad. Everything my son knows, everything my son is, he has become as a result of hanging out with you. And my son went through his own struggles, I guess, a little before, I don't know how long ago it started, but just before he was 18 years old, I had people saying to me, you know, I think Patrick's smoking marijuana. Well, he couldn't be. He's been raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. The school was calling me, and his grades were slipping. I said, you know, he must be one of those kids that's just, school's not important to him. In his early 20s, it'll be important, then he'll do better. I was in the ring with alcohol. Whenever I get into the ring, I lose. Whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it, or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it, and I'm in the ring with it. And I'm making excuses for my son, and I'm justifying. And my roommate found a bag of marijuana in his room. I don't know what she was doing in there, but she brought out a bag of marijuana from his room, and I said, oh, it probably belongs to one of his friends. Justifying. And one night, Patrick came home, and it was about midnight, and it was a Friday night, and he walked in the house, and I stood up, and God did for me what I could not do for myself. He's my only child. I'm a single parent. I've been a single parent his whole life. And he walked in the house, and out of my mouth came these words that I would have never spoken to my son. Out of my mouth comes the question, Patrick, are you loaded? He didn't miss a beat. He said, no, I'm just tired. I mean, he had heard me do it over and over and over. And I looked at him and I said, you know, if you're tired, you need to come home earlier. But you have to make a choice. You can either smoke dope or you can live in my house, but you can't do both. My son went into his room and 10 minutes later he came out with his backpack over his shoulder. And he had made a choice. Intellectually understand that choice. I made that choice over and over and over. Intellectually understand it. But as a mother, when my son made that choice, it broke my heart, and he walked out of my house. And he struggled for the last 8 years. He's come to AA once in a while, like when he gets a drunk driving, and he's brought friends here because he knows they need it. But he struggled for 8 years with his demons. And on September 14th, my son got a sobriety date. And next to my sobriety date, October 4th, 1975, September 14th, 2000 is the greatest gift that I have ever been given. My son has 65 days. My son has 65 days of sobriety, and I was here 14 years ago, and Patrick was 12, and he came with me when I came here, and you showed us a great time. And I talked to him on Wednesday, and I told him I was coming to Y on Thursday. He's 26 years old, and he was, Mom, how come you're not taking me? And I told him if he's on his fifth birthday in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would bring him to this convention. So, you know, and if I wouldn't have stayed, I'd have missed it. If I wouldn't have stayed, I would have missed a lot of miracles. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. I only came here to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And I have gotten so much more. There's a God that has a plan for me beyond my wildest imagination. And I have a wild imagination. There's a God that has a plan for me beyond anything I could ever plan for myself. If a single day in the last 25 years I'd had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. My job, it seems to me, is to not drink, get up, and live life to the fullest. And the rest of it is God's business. And when I can do that, on the days that I'm able to do that, I go to bed at night full, beyond anything I could do for myself. I'm going to end. I love talking. Now, once I get started, I'm like a compulsive talker. But I have to leave for the airport, so we're going to quit. I'm going to end with the story that puts it together for me, and it's a story of the guy that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. And St. Peter takes him to a room, and it says hell on the door, but when they open the door, it's a banquet. Tables and tables and tables of food, any kind of food you could ever imagine, as much food as he'd ever want. But the people sitting in that room amongst all that food are starving, they're dying, they're hungry. And the reason they're hungry is they have those long wooden spoons that folks use to cook with. Those spoons are tied to their hands, and they're just a little bit too long, and they can't quite get the food to their mouth. And so they're sitting amongst plenty, and they're dying. And that's how I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was dying. And then he took him to a room marked heaven, and inside that room's the same scene, tables and tables and tables of food. As much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. And the people in that room had those spoons tied to their hands, too, and the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. But the people in that room were full, and they were happy, and they were content. And the difference was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the man next to him. And he was taking a spoonful of food and feeding the woman across the table, and she was feeding somebody else. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. For me, I don't have my own answers. I have to come here, and I have to let you feed me. And if I'm lucky, every once in a while, I get to give a spoonful of this thing to another human being. And you don't have to have 10 years or 5 years or a year. The fellow with 2 days, you have something to give to the man or woman walking through the door. If you have 1 day, you have something to give to the person sitting next to you. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover. Cowards drink and use. I did that on a daily basis for 13 years. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover. And I don't have it. So I come here and I sit with you. And at the end of the meeting, the person on the right will give me a little courage. And the person on the left will give me a little strength. And you give me the courage and strength that I need to continue to choose to recover. And if you have 1 day, you'll be given the person on the right a little courage, and you'll be given the person on the left a little strength. And one more time, we'll be able to do what I can't. We'll be able to continue to live this life that is something beyond anything any of us could imagine for us. We'll be able to do it a day at a time because we're doing it together. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. If I didn't get drunk, my life would get different, and he didn't lie to me. And the thing I end with, I always end with it, and I end with it because it's been my experience, and I pray, God, it's your experience. It's a line in chapter 5 that says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.